One old farmer who had only daughters that, when they started to ripen, considered none of us local boys ever quite good enough. For a while there, laboring to decide which city college to send them, as none of the three ever much favored opening books, began to have kind of a mailbox problem, which pretty near every night then would explode from a cherry bomb or ball bat or hit off the bumper of a speeding car, sail in the ditch or the cornfield where he would find it next morning, straighten out best as he could and prop back, which, as you know, can get old. And even when it turned up missing, wasn't no way stopping Lonnie, who loved any excuse to hand-deliver college mail to sweet young things himself. And the deputy sheriff in these parts, when the call came in from Ed Holt's destruction of property, etc., said he would run on out, have a look when he had a minute, but figured some kind of courting ritual he should leave well enough alone to run its course, seeing as peacekeeping, his bounden duty, never said boo about making no federal case. So Ed finally reckoned it was all up to himself. And after spending chilly nights out in a sleeping bag, being woken up time and again by the old slam bang, fired up the forge from when he had horses and welded a plate of steel on the end of half a railroad rail, and pounded the thing 12 feet down in the ground, and bolted the old mailbox back on top, doing the whole thing late one night after dark, not telling the girls or his wife one whisper about it, and waited out in the field there and fell asleep and woke to a God Almighty crash, jumped up, and there we all set, an old jalopy hung up on his trap, two heads through the windshield, four of us boys all pretty shaken up, and everyone so sorry, sorry, none more so than Edward Holtz himself, as he picked up and held every one of us as if we were his own, tearful and thankful and amazed at what his life had run up against.
A couple of kids were hurt bad through that, I'm guessing.
Yeah. But that's a story out of my mother's childhood. Those four boys are in a Model A or a Model T. You know, they're in a rickety old car.
You're going to tell that story. And when you're sitting down to write the poem, I'd like for you to sort of take us through the process. Do you have a sense of how it's going to end up? Is it going to end up with that image? Or do you know where you're going? Or does the process sort of lead itself? You mentioned earlier that it's a discovery process for you.
Right. And telling a story is one of those special, you can develop it. It's a muscle like any muscle, and you can learn how to do it. Although the intuition that carries you so that you know you've nailed it all the way down to the ground.
That's 12 feet deep too.
Yeah. Then when you've made that connection. But storytelling is one of those little or lesser appreciated arts that a lot of my work relies on. I think that one of the things that happens is when audiences hear that there is a story afoot, their ears kind of perk up and they let go of things. They go, oh yeah, this is, you know, jokes are stories. We don't know where they're going to end. We know they're going to end. As soon as somebody, you can relax into the confidence somebody's going to tell you a story. I wrote that piece several times. This is one of those pieces that's been around a long time. But one of the things that I do is I didn't go back to my archives and dig up an earlier version, because I remember all the details of the story only too well, that this guy welded up this mailbox and, you know, was so frustrated by these kids who were kind of flirting with his daughters, and maybe they thought they were too good for the local boys, or maybe it was him who thought his daughters were too good for the kids. But it lit up when I figured that I would tell the story from the viewpoint of one of the guys, one of the kids in the car, that I was one of those kids. You know, I've been around girls whose parents wouldn't have me and said, this one is going to come to no good. He doesn't look like the kind who's going to, you know, keep a tie around his neck create the right kind of environment.
Did you know where it was headed, though?
No, it actually surprised me. This one did. And finally, I came around to the crash, and there's Ed Holtz. He's got to pick up those kids, because this is before aid cars. This is also out in the country, before dawn, out in the dark.
You're not calling 911 waiting for the ambulance, no.
No. And that story, my mother told me that story when I was probably 12 years old. And I was utterly baffled by it. And I remained baffled by it, and finally through several incarnations of it, until I finally got to this poem. And I think this is the core of the story, at least the feeling of the story is that there is a confusion that ends in a union.
Yeah, and this is the final version of it.
Yeah.
How do you know when a poem's the final version? You know, I get a sense that you're writing poems similar to the way that you might make a cabinet, and there's a little sanding that needs to be done, then a little painting, lacquering, what have you.
Every now and then. Well, unlike the wood, where if you ding it pretty good with a hammer, you're never going to be able to take the ding out. You will see the ding every time you look at it. Interesting thing about writing is that you can take some of the dings out. But it's a funny medium, you know. You've got to work it. It's a plastic medium, and you got to work it before the cement hardens.
Well, yeah. Then you can't get the dings out. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. If I waited. A year or two or five, and then came back to it, I may be able to make it better, but I couldn't make it feel whole.
Because you can't access the same state that when you were writing it.
Right.
But let me ask you, sometimes if you don't fix a ding, one of those quote-unquote dings, and you come back 5 years later and you find the ding has intelligence that you didn't realize was there, does that ever happen to you?
Well, sure. There are things... That's a wonderful thing about this medium, is that the language that we're working with is sometimes smarter than we are. And somehow, unbeknownst to ourselves, we pick a phrase, we turn to a detail, we pick something that is wiser than, the language is wiser than we are.
And yet sometimes it isn't. You have to go back and tighten it up and take out the commas and take out the periods. There's not one comma or period in the book. There are a couple of dashes. As far as punctuation goes, that's it.
This was a test of my courage, actually, if I could do this, because, in fact, as a student, I probably spent the most of my time in graduate school studying Shakespeare, and there's a text. We have three long sheets of paper, and it's called the Sir Thomas More fragment. And it's a play that most scholars now believe these three pages are in Shakespeare's hand, and they're Shakespeare's writing. And the interesting thing about them is there is almost no punctuation at all in any of the lines. He also doesn't care much about spelling. He kind of lets that go by the wayside. But the Sir Thomas More fragment's a very interesting document to kind of wake you to the possibilities of poetry. One of the things that Shakespeare, if the guy who wrote that was Shakespeare and whoever wrote it was a good poet, is that he had the feel, he has the feel of the sound of the phrase, and often the sound of the phrase is beautiful and it's nonsense. And then he comes back, and you can see the person who comes back and tries in some cases to change the words to make it make sense, to make it make logical sense. And sometimes he succeeds, and sometimes he tries a couple of different things and then just gives up. And the music of language, we don't know how to kind of honor the music of language, especially, you know, and here I am writing in the voices of these taciturn, dry-witted Midwestern farmers who didn't talk much, and it would be hard to get them on a roll, to get them to string sentences together and to go somewhere with it. I mean, like, I've got a piece in there about that the first time that I ever heard, that I ever got Bill Ward to say more than two or three sentences together, he started ranting one morning about quick oats, that old-fashioned rolled oats was the only way to do them, and there weren't quick anyway because it took so long to get a fire going in his stove to boil the water. It didn't make any difference. You know, with a microwave, maybe you're going to save 45 seconds with your quick oats or a minute and a half. So maybe you'll be able to, you know, gobble half a bowl where you would just have to skip breakfast. But it still is a wonderful kind of thing. And he had lots to say about it. It was quite, it kind of, once he got started on it.
I'm trying to find that poem.
Here it's.
And just the way it ends, I recall, just the way it ends, it sort of ties in with our theme of, you know, a slower time and some things, you know, being worth the wait. Really, all things being worth the wait, don't you think?
Yeah. If you, that to savor them, I mean, you want me to just read the end of that?
Well, what poem is that?
That's called Start the Day. You know, and to start the day, and it just happened that we had just combined a load of oats, and hauled it to market.
Maybe that last stanza would be starting with every way fine and dandy.
He's arguing about how you can cook your oats, soak overnight and fry up in a skillet, every way, fine and dandy, creamy or crunchy, anywhere in between, long as you got milk and brown sugar to go on top, maybe a handful of raisins, long as it isn't quick oats, chopped up with steel knives in a factory, not run between rollers the old way, made bitter, I swear I can taste a real difference, and quick is no way to start the day.
Yeah, I'm down with that one. Well, Belongings, Straight to Work, and For the Miracle are all fine selections on which to close our interview. Do you think one of those would be a good choice, or maybe one of your own? Belongings, Straight to Work, and
sure.
For the Miracle, yeah.
let me read Belongings. How about that? I wrote this piece because that world of my grandfather, you know, he died at 86, and
this is your mother's father.
This is my mother's father in Dover, Indiana, and my mother's next older sister had taken care of her parents in their old age, and when they died, she stayed in the same house and stayed in the same house until she died. And so when she died, all of their stuff finally was dispersed. And I've been thinking about this dispersal business because that's what it's about. You know, and the word belongings has the word longing in it. It has the word long. As if to remind us of the body's dispersal back to its elements, till after a short time only the hardest handful remains the one place one ended. So the things that a body gathers first out of need, then keeps hoarding, tools in vestigial pockets, linger on, time out of mind, till past the end, any object treated as friendly must long to be forgotten. So out of the mainstream, one gathers a few pictures, images, books, bits of wood cunningly fashioned, stones, metals, papers, coverings, instruments, cloth, paint, feather, skin, bone, scraps of never mind, whatnot, that in that instant are signaled to return to the living via bequest and memento, via deception, outright theft, flame and sword, even Salvation Army goodwill and trash heap. Passing on the sweet shine of youth, the gleam of the substantial among the lacy tattering release of the insubstantial, to begin again the migration of things beyond rightful owners, caught up, carried on, let go, like so many stones in the road, winding down alongside rushing waters. So we have to turn loose of it all. And maybe like this printing, you know, print shop has endless piles of little pieces that have to fit together, and you have to have a complete set of everything, of things called furniture and spacing. You know, when you're out of sorts, that expression means you're out of spacing material, so you can't do anything. It's an invisible thing. I'm out of sorts. Why is he so crabby?
That's what you need to go into to the department store, go to the section where they have the sorts, get a few extra of those, you won't be out of sorts anymore.
Right. But, that, you know, the world of farming is, here was, you had to have a complete set of tools and be versatile enough to be able to make your own tools if necessary.
Have we lost that forever, you think?
Well, we create these cars that no one can work on anymore. We could just as easily reverse engineer almost everything we have so that you could fix it. It requires a mindset that we don't want to have.
Is that mindset part of the virus that you see eating the planet?
I certainly do. Yes.
Hey, thanks for being on the program. Thanks for your fine work and your dedication and your commitment to the community. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Paul Hunter has been our guest. His new collection is entitled Breaking Ground, and it's available through Silverfish Review Press.